There's a theory in the world of Dharma talks, Dharma picture theory talks. The theory is that the Dharma talks are really meant for the Dharma teacher. And they usually talk about what they need to hear. So with that as an introduction today, perhaps today's talk is more for myself. So if the talk is challenging for you, then you can keep in mind that it is meant less for you than for me. So begin with an analogy. You know, we don't know how long any of us have to live, but say that we have a few decades. And then imagine all the food that you're going to eat in the next few decades. And imagine it, you know, piled up in this room. There's a big pile, you know, I don't know if it probably fit in this room, all the food you're going to eat for the next two, 3 decades, however long you're going to live. So imagine all this food piled up high. And then imagine looking at a pile of food. I can't see that much food. That's too much. That's too intimidating, it's too difficult, it's too just too much. And just the idea of contemplating all that food might give some indigestion. So, when we look at this spiritual practice, Buddhist practice, it's easy to look at the big picture in a similar way and get indigestion. You know, to think about the great possibilities of what Buddhist practice can lead to. Great experience of awakening, great awakening of compassion within us. Right, you know, wonderful things can develop, great concentration states. And some people kind of read these wonderful books on Buddhism and get a big picture of it, and then they get indigestion, or they get discouraged, or they get so excited they try to take the whole thing in one gulp, and then they get indigestion, and problems arise. And so there's various problems that can arise when you get the big picture of what Buddhist practice can be about. And in fact, just like with the meal that you eat, you have to take one meal at a time, you know, one bite at a time. And eventually take one bite at a time, eventually, you know, over these decades, you eat a lot of food. So over the many years in which you practice, you take one bite at a time of practice, one step at a time, one breath at a time. And slowly, you begin building and accumulating a sense, building a momentum, building a strength of practice, building capacity for mindfulness, for concentration, for compassion. And these things grow, and eventually, maybe you get the full meal. But the idea is you do it in all little steps. And the challenging part of this talk today is the idea that the little steps are sometimes the hardest to do. That sometimes it's easier for people to have the idea, oh, I'm going to go off on some great retreat. You know, that's really where I'm going to practice. I'm going to go sit the long retreat, 3 months in Burma. I'm going to go, you know, 10 days or something. I'm going to do this big thing. And then I'm going to really kind of get zapped. I'm really going to have a great experience and I'll get those momentum going. And I'll come back from that retreat just shining. Everything will go smoothly in my life. And so then people won't think about practice at all. And then in months, in years, they preparing themselves to go off on that big long retreat. And then maybe they do a long retreat of some kind, and then they come back from the retreat and they don't think about practice again. No, you know, just they kind of rely on the fact, oh, I did this great thing. And I think it's really a pity to have that kind of approach to, you know, certainly the life of meditation, the life of mindfulness. And that life of mindfulness should be made up of the moments, how you live your life. And it was Thomas Merton who said, Catholic monk, who said, a spiritual life is first of all a life. It has to be how you live. And how you live is not about so much about these big pictures, these big ideas, but it has to do a lot about the very simplicity of, you know, how you pick up a glass of water, how you open and close a door. Thomas Merton also said, in his years of Catholic monastic training, someone asked him, what did you learn in all those years of training? And he said, I learned to open and close doors. Now, for one of the greatest Catholic monastics of the 20th century, to summarize his years of monastic life is learning how to open and close doors. And most of you know how to do that. So, is that kind of speaks pretty poorly for monastic life? The idea being that many people don't actually open the doors with real attention and care. And they're not really present in some full way for the opening of the door. And I know it's easy enough to walk out of here or walk out of other places and hardly notice the doors being open and closed when you open and close it, because we're in a hurry to get someplace. The greed or the desire or the distraction or the fear or the reaction mode we're in, the distraction we're in, precludes the possibility of really being present for the simplicity of opening the door. And then we think about that, opening the door? I mean, that's so boring. I mean, opening, there's no spirituality in doors. These pieces of wood, you know, with metal hinges and stuff. And what's that about, the door? And the point is not the door. The point is how we are in relationship to the door and how we're present for the door. And discovering ourselves in the process of the door, the door. And I think it's really an amazing, wonderful thing when people come to me and come and say, you know, it's fine, I've been meditating for a long time, I've been in retreats for a while, and now I'm really interested in how to integrate this or apply this in my daily life, ordinary activity of my life. And that's a huge transition, I think, that some people will make. I can remember after a year of doing regular meditation practice myself, there came a moment where I realized that the mind that I had in meditation was the same mind I had in daily life. And the sense of inner integrity that I had, peace that I had in meditation practice, I wanted it to be my rest of my life as well. Why have that divide between what I do in the cushion and what I do the rest of my life? And so then the quest for me for a long time was how to bring the presence, the integrity I had when I meditated into my daily life. And I went through, many, many choices I made in my first 5-6 years of practice and going off in monasteries and stuff. It was really an attempt to answer that quest, to try to, how can I bring this presence that happened in meditation into my daily life? In opening a door. And how I drive my car, how I chop my vegetables, how I talk to my friends, how I, all the details. So some of you know the story that I have told before, but in this regard, of two young men who enter the monastery at the same time. And one is a young aristocrat, capable, smart, accomplished, used to kind of getting his way in the world, used to kind of, because of his great capacity, accomplishing whatever he sets out to do. And so he entered the monastery. And the abbot asked, why are you here? And he said, I'm here to experience the full luminosity and power of the Dharma. And the abbot said, be careful what you ask for. But invited him in and showed him where he was placed in the meditation hall to sit. As soon as he had a free moment, he ran off to the meditation hall. You know, you don't bring your shoes in, so he kicked off his shoes and flung them off to the side and jumped on his cushion, sat down with all that capacity and concentration he had. Pretty quickly, actually, he got pretty concentrated. It was pretty great. He had great capacity. And that really spurred him on, because he had great zeal, and yes, it's working, and you could feel the heat building up, and the luminosity began to happen, and this is it, this is really good. And a few more minutes of that, then suddenly he spontaneously combusted. And all that was left was ashes on his cushion. Careful what you ask for. So then the second man who entered the monastery at the same time, of course, in this story, can imagine, you know, he's not the aristocrat, he's the peasant's son. And uneducated peasant's son, perhaps. And then he comes into the monastery, and the abbot asks him, "What are you here for?" And he says, "I'm here to experience the Dharma in the work that I do, in the food that I eat, the water I drink, and my encounters with the other people that I meet." And so the abbot says, "Well, welcome, come in." So this monk comes into the monastery, and he gets settled in, and when it's time to go to the hall where everybody else can do the meditation, he goes towards the meditation hall, comes to the shoe rack outside, he takes off his shoes and he places them in the shoe rack, and then he kind of takes a moment and looks and realizes actually he put his shoes kind of askew. He looked at that and he said, "Oh, I'm actually really excited. This is my first day in the monastery. I'm excited, a little bit carried away. I wasn't so present." So he goes up forward to kind of adjust his shoes. When he does that, he sees that his shoes are really old. He's had them for many, many years. The soles in the bottom of the shoes are kind of worn out. And you know, I remember when those shoes were brand new, and how quickly the shoes went from new to old. And I'm a new monk in this monastery. I think it's really, really quickly, it's going very fast before I become an old monk here in this monastery. And there have been other monks here for a long time. Time passes very quickly. And then he looked on those shelves and he saw actually there was, the way he placed his shoes in the shoe rack, he was actually kind of taking up places of two shoes. And he thought, well, if I move my shoes over a little bit, it'll be a little bit easier for the other monks who come to put their shoes up on the shoe rack as well. And so he moved his shoes open, and he walked into the meditation hall, and this monk spent his monastic life with him. Soon enough, even how soon, he became liberated himself. So, such a simple thing, right? How you put your shoe in the shoe rack. And how much can you see in the simplicity of that act? You know, how much is available in looking at shoes? Is it shoes or just shoes, right? But, you know, he saw impermanence in the shoes. He saw his relationship to the other monks in the monasteries and the shoes and the shoe racks. So much kind of opened up for him. So much it didn't open up for the first monk. He just kind of tossed the shoes to, you know, aside and jumped in and ran into the meditation room. When I am on retreat, there's really a stark contrast sometimes about how different people behave on the retreat when they're not meditating. There are some people, they sit very well, solid, maybe. Wow, that person's sitting really well. And then when the bell ends the sitting, they kind of pop out of their seat and they kind of, it's not dashing the meditation center, as I know, but they're kind of walking out to the meditation hall as if they're in a subway station. You know, you can watch them, and just the way they walk and they open the door, it's very clear that they're not really embodied in the present. They're not a presence of mind there. You can see they're pulled off into the world of the thoughts and going off a tea or meals or this or that, and just kind of in their body language, you feel, you can see them. They're carried away into their mind. And other people get up from their seats and they stand and they start walking. You feel they're present, they're embodied. There's a presence of being, presence of mind, presence of heart, kind of there. They're there for that activity, as opposed to already in their thoughts about someplace else. So the challenge is, that I want to offer you is that I think for real serious, you want to be really serious about Buddhist practice. Well, I'll say it this way. If you want to be lazy about doing Buddhist practice, then you put it all off until you can go on retreat. And if you want to be serious about Buddhist practice, you approach Buddhism in the details of how you live your life, in the small things of your life. If you really want to be serious, if you don't want to be serious, then you can just, you know, put it off. But if you want to be serious, in those little details, you know, how you pick up glass of water. I shouldn't have done that because, you know, demonstrate, trying to, you know, I don't want to be busted for doing it the wrong way. But remember many years ago, when I was a pretty new Zen student at Sensei in the 70s, there was a conference, some kind of conference meeting or something, of some of the most senior, or the most senior, Zen teachers in America. And at that time, it was like seven or nine of them. And it was quite an inspiring gathering. And I think they come mostly to talk with themselves, do shop talk, teacher meeting. But there was also a time when they met with the students at the center I was staying at. But they had meals, and some of the Zen students, they would serve the meals and serve the tea and stuff like that. And one of the students who was helping to serve said something to me that really had a big impact on me. And the student said, you know, I served all these famous Zen masters. Most of them just ignored that I was there. They were talking to themselves. But there was one who turned to me and was present with me, gave me as much presence as they were giving each other. These always important people. As if the person is the young Zen student who knows as important as the fellow Zen master. And that little story struck with me. Because how often, how easy it is maybe to dismiss some people or not really give people our full presence. Well, this person isn't as important, this person isn't my good friend, this person, this whatever. And so we kind of don't stop and really dare for that person to fall away. So the Dharma, if we're serious about the Dharma, it's stopping. You know, it's really engaging in simplicity. How do we bring ourselves through the simple acts? I know I have to watch myself how I drive my car. There can be greed in my driving. Greed of getting somewhere quickly. You know, I could have kind of little tension in my chest or in my right foot. You know, I get pushed up, gas pedal down. And the way I hold the steering wheel. You know, I can find myself, or I can be relaxed. I can find my freedom when I drive my car. So rather than waiting for freedom far into the future, the Big Bang freedom, is there freedom in how you drive your car? Is there freedom in how you open doors? Is there freedom in how you meet someone, a stranger or a friend or something? Where's the freedom there? So the point I'm trying, one of the points I'm trying to make here today is that to look for freedom, to look for non-clinging, to look for presence and mindfulness in those small details of life, in some ways is more difficult than other times. But also, in some ways, it's much easier. We're not asking for the rocket science of Buddhist practice to open the door with care, to put your shoes in the shoe rack with care, to do these things with mindfulness and presence. It's not like such a huge, difficult thing. But the consequence of doing that is eating one bite of a huge meal, that the accumulation of building of that built momentum builds strength, begins integrating, begins challenging you, begins showing yourself, showing you what drives you, what motivates you, in a way that is very, very effective in training you or awakening in you a radically different way of living in your life. So rather than kind of looking for the big solutions, reading some great book in Buddhism and then looking for some great solution, just that'll do it for me. It's in the small details of their life. That's where it's important. Meeting the people you meet. So I wanted to give a couple of practical, somewhat ideas about how to make this more real for you. And the first is the idea of doing one thing at a time. Of course, it's fine to multitask. After years in a Zen monastery, I was sent to a Zen center I had back then, ran a Green's restaurant. And so I was, I was sent, $60 a month, monastic stipend, to work 5.5 days a week at Green's restaurant as a cook. And I loved it. It was really fun. But it was not doing one thing at a time. Fast order cook, you have to feed all these different meals and all these ones. It was like great. I was doing one thing at a time, which was just being a pastor or a cook. But it meant doing many details at all once. So to do one thing at a time, whether it's one particular thing, just drinking that glass of water or drinking a glass of water, or just being present for the complexity of this thing you're doing now, there's something very powerful about doing one thing at a time. And I can see in my life how easy it is to want to multitask and do more than one thing. And but the kind of the depth of contact with life, the depth of contact with yourself that's possible, is it kind of available in doing that one thing at a time. So when I was in a monastery in Japan, I had to, for a while, it was my job to carry the dinner food and the pots and stuff to the table where we were going to eat. And they had this pot of rice that had handles on it. And it was really easy just to grab one of the handles. It wasn't such a heavy pot to hold it and carry it in one hand. And one of the senior monks came over to me and said, "Gil, when you carry that rice, you carry it with two hands." And the idea being partly it was respect for the rice, but partly it was also when you do something, do it with your whole body, do it with your whole being, as if this thing is worth doing. Not casually, like you're kind of doing it on the side, but really kind of entering and do that one thing. And you see that, I saw that a lot, I was training a lot that was Zen training. You actually enter in and do things, you know, with your whole being. And I had a tremendous difficulty with this, not tremendous, but I had some difficulty with this and learning from it. And I'm learning to chop carrots, vegetables, at the Zen monastery. I was assigned to the cook in the kitchen for a while. And I thought the real Zen training was in the meditation home. And after I was in the monastery in the first year, I was assigned to work in the kitchen. And I said, "Oh no, that's not real Zen training. I can't do the meditation practice." And so it was kind of a challenge for me, but you know, there was no arguing. So I went to work in the kitchen. And so I had to chop a lot of vegetables. And half of me was still somewhere else. I wanted to be in meditation, I wanted to be somewhere else. And in Zen, you're trained to kind of be mindful of your body, how your body is when you're doing something. So I kept noticing my body was turned towards the door. And like I was there with chopping like the vegetables, kind of with one hand. But I would, you know, and then I would turn myself back and really face that carrot, just me and the carrot. And then, you know, and then, you know, after a while I could see kind of this, you know, various attitudes would come in that wouldn't quite be there. And that my attitudes were demonstrated in my posture of the carrot. Okay, just me. The oneness of carrots. And it was great training. Training of kind of meeting something with the fullness of, you know, the body. Just doing one thing at a time and doing it kind of wholeheartedly, fully. Doing one thing. So, you know, I remember talking to a monk at the Zen monastery in Japan. He was working in the kitchen. I think he was chopping something in the kitchen. He was chopping. And I went to ask him something. And he put down his knife. And he answered me. He picked up his knife, started chopping. So I asked him something else. And then he put down his knife. And he answered me. And I'm kind of slow, right? So I didn't register what he was doing. And so, and he picked up his knife and started chopping again, so I asked him something else. And then he put down his knife and said, "Thank you. You know, it's normally fine for you to ask questions of me, but, and, you know, I'm trying to do vegetables, chopping the vegetables, and if you're going to talk to me, I can't do both things at the same time. I'm not going to do both things at the same time. My training is to be here for this thing." So I said, "Oh, okay." So then I shut up. So that was kind of inspiring to see. Another Zen story. We spent 7 days on the Zen Sesshin, Zen retreat. And sitting near me was a Japanese monk. He'd been praying for many, many years in a Japanese monastery. He had a different way of being. He could really feel than people around me, the other sensitive to that. He had a much stronger sense of presence. He was really there. And embodied full way, it felt to me. Whatever he did, it's there, just there. And during those 7 days, the first day of the retreat, the ritual or the way it's done is they came and give you an empty teacup. That your teacup for the 7 days, keep it by your seat. And every afternoon they bring tea in the meditation hall to revive and keep you going. Tea and a cookie. And so you eat this tea and your cookie. It's a very meditative way. It's a very nice thing to do. And then at the last day, after having served tea the last time, because it was the last day, we didn't need the teacups anymore, they came and retrieved them. And they came and these trays, pick them up in the meditation hall. So everyone's sitting in meditation posture. Having finished our tea, they come in a formal choreographed way, and they do exactly like a museum, and they come with the trays, and then you put your empty teacup on the tray, and then you take them off to the kitchen to get them off. And so I was sitting near this Japanese monk, and when it was his turn to give the teacup up, first, before he gave it up, he bowed to the teacup. He bowed to the teacup. And that inspired me. I don't bow to teacups very often. But it inspired me about offering not just presence to what we do, but to a degree of respect to the things of our life. Things that we use, things that we encounter. So to do one thing at a time. And then to do it wholeheartedly, fully. Now, some people think that in order to really practice Buddhism, you should go off to a monastery. We've got all these monastic stories today. That's what real Buddhism is. But one of the things you encounter if you go to a monastery is they do a lot of the same things that you do. You know, a lot of the ordinary things of life that all of us have to do. They wash dishes, they wash their clothes, they sweep, they clean, they cook sometimes. They have conflict with their friends, you know. There's all kinds of things that go on there that are not so different from what you do. They go to the bathroom. But the difference is not the activity they do. The difference from us, people in lay life outside of monastery. But rather in the monastic context, there's a stronger reminder to endow each of those, or power each of those activities, the simple, ordinary activities, with value. So we're more likely to bring that presence, bring that mindfulness, as if this is important, this counts. In daily life, you know, it's the same activities here, but somehow we don't remember as often, we're not reminded as often, this really counts, this is important. Sweeping my kitchen is, you know, that's a practice of mindfulness, a practice of awakening, right there. So to do one thing at a time. The other thing, which is a little bit related to the first, that might help in this endeavor, is a steadiness of purpose. And that is, when you're going to do something, hold steady to it within reason. And I notice sometimes when I go around my house, and it's time to move the laundry from the washing machine to the dryer. So I'm going to walk from one part of my house to where the washing area is. So that's the purpose, is to go from here to there. But then I walk around, look at that. The magazine's being tidied up. There's a cookie up on the shelf. Look at that. There's this to be done. The mail just came. I'll go up and check the mail. And so, I kind of wander around. I'm not really, doing all these different things. And eventually I get to the laundry area and do my laundry. So it's fine to live that way. It's not a problem. It doesn't have to be a problem. But there's something different happens, a different momentum happens, if you kind of begin to develop the strength of steadiness of purpose. Okay, I'm going to do this now. I'm going to just follow through until this is done, within reason, okay? I'm going to go down to the laundry room. I'm just going to do that. That's the one thing I'm going to do. It creates a simplicity, and it creates an easier ability to stay focused and be present for what you're actually doing and doing. If we're easily moved about and distracted, then it would much more easily scatter in the mind as well. You're less centered or grounded. So that's simple enough in our houses, maybe going through our laundry. But it's also true in the bigger things of our life. And some of you, I'm sure, know this. You know, you set yourself in a big task in your life. You know, a particular career you want to do, or some bigger activity you want to accomplish. And there needs to be a steadiness of purpose. And sometimes also there has to be a decision that there's a lot of worthwhile things to do and interesting things you want to do. But then you have, sometimes we have to separate out and decide not to do some of the worthwhile things. So there can be a steadiness of purpose and a clarity about something we're going to do and follow through all the way, as far as we can. So it's certainly true for Buddhist practice that if you want to make that the real purpose of your life, the central purpose of your life, then to have a steadiness of purpose around that, that includes a decision to let go of some things that might be worthwhile, but just don't kind of, you know, you can't do it all. If you really want to do one thing well, a few things well, you can't do everything. And the beauty of Buddhist practice is that you know, there can be both this bigger decision of really focusing on that to a greater degree. And there's a beauty of the fact that it also doesn't require you to your life to be much different than it is, in principle. It requires you simply to offer the details and moments, the momentary details of your life, real presence, as if it counts, as if it's important. As if that's where the training, the development happens. And if you think that the details of your life, the details of how you drive your car, or open the door, put your shoes in the shoe rack, whatever you do, those details don't count, then I would strongly encourage you to stop and look at those beliefs. And look at what you really believe counts more than that. And why you think it counts more than that. Then look at that. And I think that reflection and contemplation will reveal a lot. Be challenged by it. So, those are my thoughts for today. And that's my challenge to you. Because I'm still learning how to do this. Better and better. More and more. So, thank you for this morning. And I would like to say one more thing. Since I talk about these things that could apply to here, like how you leave here and open and close the doors, and how you treat your shoes here, you know. And now you're going to wonder, oh no, I was that person who just threw my shoes out on the floor. And, you know, I think I'll go home without shoes today. So no one notices that you know, I'm the one who is so mindless. There's a great rule among Buddhist monastics. They have a series of rules about how you're supposed to eat, including eating this big bowl, kind of like this, much bigger. And they're not supposed to be to organize their food that they get, like in kind of careful ways, so that they can have the entree first and the salad first and this, you know, soup second or dessert last. You're supposed to put it all in. They're supposed to be indiscriminate in how they eat, you know, mix it all together. Doesn't matter if it's, so it's kind of an odd way to eat, but they're supposed to do that. But one of the rules that they have is they're not allowed to look in the bowl of the other monastic to see how they're doing with that. So don't look and see how other people put their shoes in the shoe rack. Just look at your own.